Hello and welcome to Sound Body, a weekly program of information on health topics and ideas that can help you live life to its fullest. I'm Louise Craig. On Thursday, May 18, 2017, Pope Francis offered a message of hope and love to patients with Huntington's disease, a rare and incurable genetic brain disorder that causes intense suffering. According to organizers, it was the first time that a pope or any world leader had recognized the plight of those with the disease. In his speech, Francis said the fears and difficulties of people affected by Huntington's disease have been surrounded with misunderstandings and barriers for far too long. We will read an article from Stat News today about this large gathering of Huntington's patients, doctors, and advocates. This piece includes reporting on their experiences of living with Huntington's and also what it was like to meet with the Pope. We start with one short article from WebMD that gives a bit of a description of living with Huntington's disease. This is titled, "This Waiter Helps a Customer with Huntington's Disease Every Week." And this was written by Locke Hughes for WebMD and published on March 31st, 2017. In today's hectic world, you don't often see people taking time out of their day to help someone else from the goodness of their heart, let alone while they're busy at work. But one waiter in Springfield, Illinois, does just that every single Saturday. Joe Thomas, a server at IHOP, goes above and beyond for a couple of his regular customers, a husband and wife named Dale and Ma. Years ago, he noticed that Dale would patiently help his wife eat her breakfast, while his plate sat and grew cold, he tells Today.com. One day, Thomas offered to help, saying, "I've got this." Ever since, Thomas has helped Ma every Saturday while Dale eats, so the two can enjoy breakfast together. "We go way back," Thomas tells Today. "They're a beautiful couple. The reason why Ma has trouble eating on her own, she has Huntington's disease, a genetic disorder that breaks down nerve cells in the brain. It can cause a person to lose the ability to think rationally, walk, and speak. Other symptoms include personality changes, mood swings, depression, forgetfulness, involuntary movements, slurred speech, and difficulty swallowing. One of the earliest symptoms of Huntington's disease is a loss of coordination," says Michael Smith, MD, WebMD's chief medical editor. "Over time, it becomes increasingly difficult to control movements and ordinary activities, such as holding a fork and feeding yourself, become impossible. As the disease progresses, the family often has to step in to provide complete care for the person, as Dale has done. The stress of being a caregiver often leads to anxiety and exhaustion," Smith says. "That's why even a few minutes of relief to enjoy a relaxing breakfast can make such a difference in the life of someone caring for a chronically sick loved one." Turns out, Thomas is especially well-suited to lending a helping hand to others. He has worked as a rehab technician, helping disabled people live more independently, and also took care of his late mother who had diabetes. The heartwarming photo of Thomas helping Ma went viral after a customer posted it on the restaurant's Facebook page. In the caption, Keisha Dotson writes, "My faith in humanity has been restored a little today." She has since added an update from Dale and Ma, who thanked everyone for their kind words. Over 500 people have commented on the photo and say they're thrilled that Thomas is getting the recognition he deserves. Dale also hopes this opportunity will help raise awareness of Huntington's disease. And now we go to the Stat article. This is titled, "Families Bear the Burden of This Disease in Silence. Pope Francis Made Us Into a Community." And this is written by Mona Gable and published on August 8, 2017. "We are waiting for the Pope. He is supposed to come at 11, but then we're told he will arrive at 11:30. The crowd sighs in expectation. People turn to each other and smile, hold hands, murmur in various languages. A few rows ahead of me, a mother juggles a toddler on her lap. A folk rock band called Minor plays sweetly on stage, their voices a hymn in the cavernous concrete hall. As I gaze up at the stained glass windows, I feel like I am in church, about to be blessed, which, in a sense, I am. 2 hours ago, I walked in the mid-May morning sun through St. Peter's Square with a handful of patients from Latin America as bells rang out. Soon, we will meet Pope Francis. I'm sitting in Aula Paola VI Audience Hall in the Vatican. Around me are 1,700 people, 150 of them patients, the largest gathering ever of those affected by a fatal genetic brain disorder called Huntington's disease. HD causes a staggering array of mental and physical difficulties. There are few treatments and no cure. As if that weren't cruel enough, many people hide the disease, live in isolation, afraid of discrimination, rejection, condemnation. Nearly 6 years ago, my brother died from a wrenching mix of colon cancer and HD. The shock of his diagnosis, his suffering and bravery, and his slow, brutal death nearly broke me. For a time, my family told almost no one the truth. The stigma of HD, and particularly the plight of impoverished HD communities in Latin America, is what has drawn us to the Vatican for an event called HD Denamore, or Hidden No More. The organizers hope to shatter that stigma, but also enlist the influential Catholic Church to finally render aid to families. It's the first time a pope or world leader will speak publicly about Huntington's disease. Because society has shunned people with HD, their presence in the majestic, high-ceilinged hall is strikingly powerful. Scores of patients line the front rows, their symptoms plainly visible. Some flap their arms, jerk their heads. The sickest rock in wheelchairs. No one is ashamed. Despite everything, they have traveled from 26 countries, from as far away as Argentina and New Zealand, with an entourage of researchers, doctors, caregivers, and relatives attending them on the long journey to Rome. For some, it is the first trip beyond their hometown. I am not Catholic, although I am Episcopalian, which is similar, I like to say, only with birth control, gay parishioners, and female priests. I'm also not one to toss around religious cliches, but I feel like I'm witnessing a miracle. Before the Pope arrives, Charles Sabine works the crowd. One of the event's organizers, he is 57 and British with waves of blonde hair. Sabine's father, an uncle, and a half-brother all died of HD. He carries the genes too, meaning he will eventually show symptoms of the disease. Before he started advocating for HD, for years he traveled the world as a journalist for NBC. On stage, Sabine asks the audience, who are seated by nationality, to stand up. "Ireland," he bellows. "Spain," he shouts. "Vietnam." As each group rises, the crowd applauds and cheers. It is a profound moment, symbolizing the power of acceptance by hundreds who know their pain. At last, they are not alone. Later that day, a 79-year-old woman from Colombia, who has nurtured and buried 4 adult children with HD, tells the scientist who brought her here, "I never knew there were so many families all over the world. I thought there was just my family." In the history of HD research, Latin America figures large. In the Venezuelan towns of San Luis and Barranquitas, Huntington's is nearly 1,000 times more prevalent than anywhere else in the world. Because of poverty, lack of education, and government neglect, the disease, which is caused by a single mutant gene, flourished and spread from one generation to the next. When scientist Nancy Wexler and a team of international researchers identified the gene in 1993, the DNA of the Venezuelan families was instrumental in that discovery. Yet despite their gift to science, they never benefited. Even today, these communities live in staggering poverty, with almost no food, medicine, or means of work, or even access to the genetic test for HD. 2 families, one each from San Luis and Barranquitas, were invited to the papal audience. In a video produced by the event's planners, Maria Esther Soto Soto, a 44-year-old mother of 4, whose symptoms of HD are strikingly apparent, says, I have to ask for charity all the time to feed my children. Before they left home, she and her two siblings had never been on a plane and didn't know where Italy was. Their doctor, a gentleman named Ernesto Solis, took them shopping to a big air-conditioned mall and bought them shoes, underwear, and other necessities. In the video, someone asks Maria Esther, what is she going to say to Francis? I'm going to tell the Pope to help all of us, she says. These communities in Latin America really exemplify how disease and poverty combine at a terrible combination, not just for the patient, but for the children. Ignacio Munoz San Juan, a Spanish neuroscientist who helped organize the papal event, told me one morning in Rome. He also made the daunting 6,000-mile journey with the Latin American families. A lot of kids become caretakers when they're really young, and they never have any possibility in life at getting ahead. And with drugs to stem the disease nowhere on the horizon, the 45-year-old scientist is desperately trying to address the social problems Huntington's patients face, founding a humanitarian project called Factor H, devoted to that very task. A lot of patients end up on the streets because the families can't cope with it anymore and because there's no social structure for them, he said. I think there's something wrong that society doesn't have special protections for people with a genetic disorder like this. There should be special rights because they have special needs. As I sit in the hall, moments of drama gracefully unfold. Brenda, can you come up on stage? Asks Sabine. Smiling, the 15-year-old girl climbs the steps, her walk shaky. Brenda has come from Buenos Aires, Argentina, the Pope's hometown, with two of her doctors and an aunt who is raising her. They are essentially her only family. She used to share a bedroom with her father until he died of Huntington's on her 15th birthday. Before that, she took care of him. When Brenda started to get sick, her mother fled, taking her only sibling. Brenda can't talk very well, but like most teens, she is incredibly adept at texting. One of her doctors, Claudia Perendonis, helped plan the papal event. When she gave Brenda the elegant red envelope containing the invitation to meet Francis, the teenager furiously texted in reply, "I love you." Now Sabine wraps his arm around Brenda. Brenda likes a particular Latin American singer who plays the guitar, is that right? He asks. She nods. Isn't his name Axel? He says. And then, just like a teenage girl's fantasy, the handsome pop star strolls out on stage and embraces Brenda, who looks incredulous. The audience gasps in delight, and then, as we all watch spellbound, the musician sings to her. I instinctively put my hand on my chest and sigh. This unlikely event all began with a one-time foreign correspondent, two scientists named Elena and Nacho, and a California resort. In February 2016, the three found themselves hanging out around a table in the warm desert sun of Palm Springs, where they had gathered for a Huntington's conference. Dr. Elena Cataneo had flown over from her native Italy. Munoz San Juan, who goes by Nacho, had come from L.A., where he acts as vice president of the nonprofit CHDI Foundation, and Sabine was there, too. And though the setting was beautiful and serene, they were trying to solve a problem. The humanitarian project Nacho had launched a few years before was struggling. The NGOs he'd approached hadn't come on board, and funding was thin. I was really frustrated not being able to do anything in Venezuela, he told me one morning in Rome. The only institution that's left to help with Venezuela is the church. That's when I had the conversation with Charles and Elena. And that's when Sabine suggested matter-of-factly, let's talk to the Pope. Cataneo, by chance, knew how to make that happen. She called her friend Pierre, who had close contacts at the Vatican right then and there. I'm here with Nacho and Charles Sabine, she told him. We have this dream. We are asking for a dedicated event on Huntington's disease. And Pierre, she said, responded, we should do it. On Pierre's advice, Cataneo wrote a letter to Pope Francis requesting the audience. A few months later, she received a letter in return that the Vatican was considering the appeal. From then on, it was an earthquake, she said. Back in Italy, the prominent stem cell scientist and senator served as the liaison with the Holy See. When I talked to priests, I had the perception that they were interested in the disease, she recalled. They thought of it as a very important event and that the goal was something the Vatican would share and completely support. Still, the Vatican functions by any number of mysterious and inflexible rules, and Cataneo had to figure them out. Each domain has its own activity, but nothing is written down, so you have to learn who to talk to for this and that. Ultimately, she received a letter. The event was on. Cataneo and her friends were astounded. The news was especially remarkable because Francis had never done an equivalent event for any other disease. When Pope Francis eventually appears, he ambles across the stage, gives a little wave. There is polite applause, a feeling of awe. It's almost as if we can't believe he's really here. Seated about a dozen rows back, I lean forward to see his kind, wrinkled face. A huge silver cross dangles down the front of his white robe. His ears are very large. He sinks into a big white chair, two cardinals in black beside him, men in suits with earpieces behind him. Sabine and Cataneo say a few words, thank the Pope for his compassion and wisdom, for shining a light on our disease at last, and Brenda and Axel hand him a scroll illuminating the event's goals. The 80-year-old pontiff kisses her on the cheek, and she throws her arms around him. What a beautiful moment for Brenda, I think, whose young life has been so insufferably hard, being embraced by perhaps the most revered man on earth. When the Pope begins to read his speech, it's like hearing a prayer. The hall falls silent. People hope that Francis will speak to the extraordinary difficulties they face because of HD. He does that and more. In many cases, the sick and their families have experienced the tragedy of shame, isolation, and abandonment, he says softly in Italian, as many listen on headsets in English and Spanish. Today, however, we are here because we want to say to ourselves and all the world, hidden no more. After the speech and the applause, the Pope makes his way down the marble steps, his retinue of handlers following. He is coming down into the crowd. Everyone seems to hold their breath. At first, people are tentative. They smile, shake his hand, but seem overwhelmed. Then the Pope reaches for Maria Esther, and the tiny Venezuelan woman collapses in his arms, crying. Then her 35-year-old brother, Franklin, embraces the Pope, and then their 32-year-old sister, Isabelle, completely falls apart. "Please help us. My house is falling down," she sobs as Francis holds her and Maria Esther. As a mother who faced the possibility of having Huntington's, I feel my heart break a little. After my brother died, I got tested because I was frightened my kids were at risk. I was negative. All three of the Venezuelan siblings have children and are in the throes of the disease. For the next hour, Francis threads his way through the rows. He looks in people's eyes, listens to their stories, laughs and pats babies' cheeks. Leans down and blesses patients writhing in wheelchairs. You have never seen so many joyful sick people, families, caregivers, and scientists in one room. In turn, people deluge the Pope with kisses and hugs, photos of loved ones, books, and gifts. I laugh when a young female researcher from London asks him for a selfie, which he happily obliges. Suddenly, Pope Francis stands in front of me. He looks tired, though his soft brown eyes shine with light. I've been so absorbed watching everyone else that I'm dumbstruck, so I do what seems perfectly natural. I kiss the Pope on the cheek. Before I left for Rome, I was afraid I'd get depressed during the event because I knew people there would eventually die or because I'd be reminded of my brother. But it feels more like a celebration of life, of promise and hope. After the Pope waves goodbye, everyone lingers to savor the day. Sabine dances with his young daughter on stage, while Brenda sits nestled against Axel. People who were once strangers talk and hug each other. Researchers who've never worked together exchange business cards, email addresses, and offers of hope. Help. I don't normally do this kind of thing, but in the passion of the moment, I ask a young Venezuelan actor to take a photo with me. That night, I took a cab from my hotel near the Vatican to join everyone for a celebratory dinner. As the sun set over chaotic Rome, we settled into a neighborhood pizzeria where everyone sat around wooden tables, talking, laughing, and taking photos. The group was positively rowdy. "Vino, vino!" someone yelled when the waiter came. I was sitting with Solis, the Venezuelan doctor, and his wife Reina, Cataneo, and Franklin, Maria Esther's brother. "He wants Coca-Cola," Cataneo shouted to the waiter, pointing to Franklin. Franklin resembled his sisters with his heart-shaped face and intelligent brown eyes. Before he got sick, he made his living as a fisherman. He had never learned to read and write. When I asked him about meeting the Pope, his face opened into a big smile and he replied in Spanish, "It was beautiful." A tall man with gray hair stood near us, loudly joking with him. I wondered who he was. "That's Pierre," said Cataneo. Her friend with Vatican ties had joined the whole group for dinner. "He looks normal." "He's crazy," she warned us, and we all laughed. As we dined on pizza, Solis, a soft-spoken middle-aged man with thinning black hair, told me about the desperate situation in Venezuela. Because of the embargo, they had almost no food or medicine. When 3 days before, one of the Venezuelan patients had a breakdown in the streets of Rome, his 13-year-old son cried for his father to be given fruit juice, which is what they treated him with at home. In Maracaibo, where Solis lived, people were starving. He and Reina, who is also a doctor, had lost a lot of weight. Even as they were in Rome, Venezuela was collapsing. Their two young daughters hadn't gone to school for a few days because of the military crackdown in the streets. He loved his patients, but he didn't know how much longer he could stay in the country. The morning after the papal audience, the families gathered again for a special mass at one of the oldest churches in the city, the Basilica di Santa Maria in Trastevere. I sat next to Isbeli and Maria Esther. Isbeli, like her sister, was small and thin. Her short brown hair was pushed back with a headband. She had a wide smile that revealed her missing teeth. She was especially sweet and affectionate, always giving hugs. Before he abandoned her and their two kids, her husband used to beat her. Maria Esther's husband had also vanished. "A lot of times the men leave when things get tough," Nacho told me. Maria Esther's balance was terrible, her head wobbled, and she had trouble focusing her eyes. She was also delightfully strong-willed. One pearly evening later that week, we toured the Sistine Chapel. We were about to descend a spiral staircase when I noticed her standing alone. She looked dismayed. The group was leaving and we needed to go, but the woman who often helped her navigate such tricky situations wasn't around. So I told her I was going to help her down the stairs and gently took her arm. She grabbed the banister, her mouth set, and step by step down we went. Several times I was terrified we were going to tumble down the slippery marble steps. We didn't. Maria Esther reminded me in a good way of my brother. My brother was a warm, outgoing guy and also determined. When his involuntary body movements became severe, he refused to hide it or let it stop him from doing the things he loved. He went to football games and restaurants, his daughter's high school graduation, flew to L.A. to stay with me while he attended a conference. The man would have still skied down Black Diamonds if he could have. At the end, he still wanted to brush his teeth without help. My thoughts returned to Mass when we had reached the part of the service where parishioners and priests offer each other the sign of peace, a profound tradition where people turn to their neighbors, grasp their hands, and say, "The peace of the Lord be with you." It's to symbolize our role in humanity as peacemakers. As organ music softly played, everyone stood, extending their hands, their voices rising and echoing in the ancient stone church. For several minutes, patients hugged their caregivers, scientists embraced patients, and people left their seats to seek out loved ones. The emotion was overwhelming. Isbeli, Maria Esther, and the others from Venezuela, where peace was unimaginable, were crying. I had not cried at all during the papal event, but as I stood there hugging a patient advocate from Venezuela, tears began streaming down my cheeks. And we have time to read most of an article from Medical News Today that was published on June 8th, 2017, and is titled Blood Test Can Predict Onset and Track Progression of Huntington's Disease. The first blood test that can predict the onset and progression of Huntington's disease has been identified by a UCL-led study. The researchers say their findings published in Lancet Neurology should help test new treatments for the genetic brain disorder, which is fatal and currently incurable. This is the first time a potential blood biomarker has been identified to track Huntington's disease so strongly, said the study's senior author, Dr. Edward Wild, UCL Institute of Neurology. The test measures the neurofilament light chain, a protein released from damaged brain cells, which has been linked to other neurodegenerative diseases but hasn't been studied in the blood of Huntington's disease patients before. The team, led by scientists at UCL Huntington's Disease Center, working with colleagues in Sweden, the USA, Canada, France, and the Netherlands, measured neurofilament levels in blood samples from the TRACK-HD study, an international project that followed 366 volunteers for 3 years. They found that levels of the brain protein were increased throughout the course of HD, even in carriers of the HD genetic mutation who were many years from showing symptoms of the disease. HD mutation carriers had neurofilament concentrations that were 2.6 times that of the control participants, and the level rose throughout the disease course from pre-manifest to stage 2 disease. In the group who had no symptoms at the start of the study, the level of neurofilament predicted subsequent disease onset, as volunteers with high neurofilament levels in the blood at the start were more likely to develop symptoms in the following 3 years. After taking into account factors already known to predict progression, age, and a genetic marker, the blood level of neurofilament was still able to independently predict onset, progression, and the rate of brain shrinkage. And we need to leave it there. Thank you for tuning into Sound Body today. Stay well and come back next week for more healthy living ideas. This has been Sound Body, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. I'm Louise Craig, and I hope you'll join me again next week for more health updates and information for healthy living. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can download a podcast of the show at our website, wxxi.org.